reporters.
The human rights groups also warn that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Recent developments in Afghanistan have marginalized attention to coronavirus crisis in the country. In the meantime, officials and doctors at Kabul's Afghan Japan COVID-19 hospital say new money has been paid to the hospital, pushing it further towards a closure.
We have many problems as the cold season is approaching. We expect another wave of the virus in coming weeks. We ask our ex-donors to pay the salaries of the employees. We can't run the hospitals on our own. If their assistance is not resumed, the only COVID-19 hospital of Afghanistan will close.
Patients getting treatment in the hospital complain about insufficient medical supplies and care, urging the international bodies to save the hospital from closing and so the lives of Afghans.
My father has contracted the coronavirus. We are here for weeks. Everything seemed okay, but today we see that the hospital suffers from lack of oxygen and medicines. Meanwhile, the doctors have not been paid for months.
This comes as the U.S. insists on freezing nearly $9.5 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank and stopped shipment of cash to the nation. The U.S. says the assets will not be available to the Taliban, which remains on the Treasury Department's sanctions designation list. In addition to many humanitarian crises, the halt in global aid and the freezing of Afghanistan's assets have led to closure of most COVID-19 hospitals in the country. This comes amid warnings that Afghanistan could face COVID-19 outbreaks in the coming year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protecting press freedom. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marching all the way to the British Royal Courts of Justice today ahead of an upcoming extradition hearing. The starting point, the BBC headquarters.
One of the main issues that we have with Assange is that his extradition, the case which is being heard next week, the whole basis of the case, the facts about the case, most of this never gets anywhere near the British media.
The U.S. government is attempting to extradite Assange under an old treaty with the U.K. for publishing damning documents of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and human rights violations elsewhere. His supporters say the charges are politically motivated.
It means basically that every journalist anywhere in the world has to be afraid of a possible extradition, especially if he is reporting on national security issues, not just by the United States or other Western countries, but by any country.
Just last month, it was revealed that in 2017, as Assange began his fifth year holdup in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the U.S. government plotted to kidnap or assassinate him on British soil. Still, the U.K. is carrying on with his trial.
It besmirches a reputation which at least the British establishment think they have got internationally. It's supposed to be a beacon of free speech. It's supposed to be a beacon of the free press. And while Julian Assange is in Belmarsh...
Since he was evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy 2 years ago, Assange has been languishing in a maximum security prison in southeast London. His next court hearing is set for October 27th and 28th. If extradited, he'll face 175 years in a U.S. prison.
It'll be a watershed moment in the most important press freedom case of the century. And these protesters say they're hoping that the U.K. government and justice system will do the right thing and put an end to what they describe as the show trial of Julian Assange. Site for Is Up, London.
In a press conference held by the Sudanese pro-civilian rule factions, the Force of Freedom and Change factions, FFC, has categorically rejected any move to dissolve the government without consent of the factions and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. Meanwhile, an unarmed group stormed the building of the Sudan news agency SUNA and used physical and verbal violence to terrorize journalists and media professions in attempt to prevent the convening of the conference, which had been announced earlier by FFC.
We in the Forces of Freedom and Change affirm our continuous support for Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and his government, who were chosen by the FFC to lead the transition in Sudan, and we reaffirm our full support and coordination with him.
Sudan has been grappling with the biggest political crisis in its 2 years old transition. The military and civilian groups have been sharing power in troubled alliance since long-standing President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in 2019. Observers believe that the only way out for Sudan's current crisis is through expanding base of participation and unification of revolutionary forces.
I assure that there is no way out of this crisis without expanding the base of participation and rearranging the internal conditions of the forces of the Sudanese revolution as a guarantor of any real transformation in the political scene.
On the other hand, protesters from the splinter FFC faction, the National Charter Alliance, have been holding a sit-in outside Khartoum's presidential palace for the seventh day, with soldiers around the site providing protection.
Time is running out for all government components without reaching a solution for the political crisis, while FCC rejects all the mediation and solution made by the military before handing over the power to the civilian next month. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
A new poll shows that 3 out of every 4 French people believes that their purchasing power has diminished due to rising inflation, and 90% of the nation is worried about it. The nation's economy minister departed from his Western peers by admitting that inflation will continue to rise until 2023 at the earliest. Combined with unemployment, which was entrenched even before the coronavirus recession, the admission seems to announce the beginning of dreaded stagflation.
La vie est chère et encore plus à Paris.
Life is expensive, especially in Paris, from real estate to basic shopping needs to even the price of a simple lunch. Our purchasing power keeps going down.
The government has just announced a cap on household gas prices until the end of 2022. Natural gas has soared to record highs across Europe. They also announced a one-time payment of 100 euros to those who earn less than 2,000 euros per month, which amounts to 60% of the population. However, many say the one-off payment is not nearly enough.
Ça devient compliqué, ça diminue fortement.
No, it's not enough at all. When somebody is only taking home 2,000 euros a month, 100 euros isn't nearly enough to make difference when it comes to the energy costs. The government is not helping the middle class much at all.
The Yellow Vest protests, which initially kicked off 3 years ago due to rising fuel prices, just began what they called Season 2 last weekend. They are promising to continue marching. By a huge margin, purchasing power is the number one issue ahead of France's presidential election next year, just as it has been in all the elections since the great financial crisis began.
It's really fragile right now. The middle class just isn't seeing a fair relationship between their work and the amount they are paid.
Inflation is being reported seemingly worldwide, as the coronavirus lockdowns may have created a monetary monster. Many economists say the only solutions are controls on prices, as well as corporate profits, and higher wages, which have remained stagnant across the West for decades. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This was the first face-to-face meeting of EU leaders since the bloc's energy crisis really came to the fore. Millions of citizens simply don't have the money to pay for electricity and gas bills, which have skyrocketed since the start of the year.
We will intensify our outreach to the different suppliers, also to diversify the supply we do have, and we have to speed up the work on interconnections.
Experts say Iran, with its enormous oil and gas reserves, is an obvious option for the EU. Illegal US sanctions are hampering exports, but that will change if the Iran nuclear deal is revived.
The real game changers will be if Iran comes into international market with full force, increasing its oil exports, increasing its gas production.
It has been confirmed that during their summit on Thursday and Friday, EU leaders debated erecting barbed wire along the bloc's external border to manage the refugee crisis, made worse by the situation in Afghanistan. Ursula von der Leyen says the idea is out of the question. On the subject of COVID-19, the EU has failed to convince citizens in some countries to take the vaccine. For example, the virus is now out of control in Romania and Bulgaria.
Some difficulties that are related to the vaccination hesitancy, and it's why it's also important to cooperate, to coordinate, in order to make also progress on this challenge.
Some EU nations want funding cut to Poland over alleged rule of law breaches. Right-wing leaders, such as Hungary's Viktor Orban, are dead against the move, though.
There is no need to have any sanction. It's ridiculous.
Germany's Angela Merkel, who gave her last press conference at an EU leaders' summit before leaving office, says she's also opposed to legal action against Warsaw. Apart from not meeting the needs of citizens and in turn allowing populism to take hold, critics say another key reason the EU is facing rule of law issues is because those running the project have been too eager to expand at all costs to create a superstate, and in the process have allowed countries to join that do not share EU values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In Sudan, ralliers remain on the streets in protest of the Monday military coup d'etat. They want the 2019 transition deal to be honored. On Monday, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan announced dissolving civilian rule and a state of emergency. Civilian cabinet ministers, including the prime minister, have been arrested. Soldiers have gunned down at least seven protesters. General Burhan argues that the coup was justified to avoid a civil war. The coup has drawn global condemnation, and the UN Security Council is due to discuss the situation today. Now to start with, let's go to London to our correspondent, Ahmed Kabbala, and see what he has for us.
Yes, so we finally heard from the mastermind behind the coup, General al-Burhan. He said that a new sovereign council will be formed in the next couple of days, a new prime minister will be appointed, as well as new judicial bodies. He's also said that he is committed to quote-unquote the transition to democracy, and he hopes to have elections in 2023. Now, unfortunately for him, the Sudanese people are not buying this. There's been calls for general strike, civil disobedience. The protests that have been going on since the military coup has been announced, and the people are fed up. You're seeing on social media, many people are talking about it. Sudan has been the number one trending topic, not only in Sudan, but around the world, following the news of the coup. And many people believe that this is a power grab and the new sovereign council will be handpicked to serve the military's interest. The new judicial body will be handpicked, the new prime minister will be handpicked The Prime Minister, Hamdok, has been taken to an undisclosed location. And the reason why, according to Burhan's statement, he was taken there was because he refused the ultimatums given to him by the military. One of those ultimatums was to read out a pro-coup statement live on air. The Prime Minister refused and he was arrested. The Information Minister, who I interviewed this time last year for Press TV, has also been detained and taken to a undisclosed location.
I see. Ahmed, I hear that you're of Sudanese descent yourself. So how would you feel, as somebody belonging to Sudan and the people there, to see so many coup d'etats in Sudan taking place and the military not being ready actually to let go of power and to let a civilian government to take power?
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating. Since 1956, when Sudan first got its independence, we've had three revolutions. One in 1964. Soon after that revolution, there was a military coup d'etat in 1969. We had another revolution in 1985. Soon after that, there was a military coup in 1989 when Omar al-Bashir took power. And then we had another revolution at the end of this of 2018. And once again, we saw another military coup d'etat. And it suggests that we need top-to-bottom reform in the military because they don't see their role as strictly protecting the country, but rather governing the country. And regardless of what decade it is in Sudanese history, it seems the military want to call the shots and dictate and are not willing to take orders from civilian-led government. And I think that this was not only predictable, but was inevitable, and it needs the Sudanese people to basically win back the gains that they made with the December 2018 revolution.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Ahmed Kabbala, our correspondent in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, from London, let's bring in a guest. We have publisher of the Africa Briefing, Jonathan Ofai-Ensa. Good to have you with us, Jonathan. So did this recent coup d'etat in Sudan catch you by surprise? You know, I'm asking this because there were many who were expecting this to happen.
Yes, I mean, the sense were there, judging from the mass demonstrations that took place last week and the week before. I mean, the people rightly sensed or saw the undercurrents that were going on and sort of held preemptive demonstrations against such an eventuality. But unfortunately, they couldn't help. And this coup took place on Monday. And like your correspondent said, the military staged the coup just because they wanted to dictate, the pace of reforms. They wanted to dictate everything that goes on within the country. And again, they feared being exposed because, look, most of these military are tainted. You take the war in Darfur, you take other sleaze that has taken place within the economy and so on and so forth. Most of them are tainted and wanted to protect themselves. And it appeared Abdallah Hamdok, the deposed prime minister, wasn't one who was prepared to play ball with them. So the only alternative left to them was to stage this coup and get rid of Hamdok, right, and place their own hand-picked people, in place. They've announced a new civilian government that will work alongside them. You've announced a planned judicial council, and all the members of these bodies are going to be handpicked by, or are going to be people who will be handpicked by this General Benham, and who will play their ball, will play their game, will work according to the dictates of the military.
Okay, now, author and journalist Robert Fantina is also joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. I should say welcome to Robert. And Robert, you know that General Burhan was supposed to cede control of the ruling council to civilian leaders in a few weeks' time. Instead, he dissolved the council. He announced a date for elections, after which he said he would hand over to an independent and fair representatives, in his own words. Now, is the military really serious about handing power over to civilian rulers? If so, why did they do it in a few weeks' time that they were supposed to do?
They are not serious about doing this, about handing power over to civilian leaders. If they were, as you said, they would have done it on the schedule that was agreed upon 2 years ago when the Bashar was overthrown and the coalition government was formed. But the fact that Burhan has now seized the government and is promising to have elections and hand over the government to civilians in another 2 years is not promising. It's not optimistic. This is going to be another military leadership, as the people of Sudan have had to put up with for decades before. They want democracy. They've demonstrated for democracy. It's what the people want, and it's what the government had promised to them. And now General Al-Burhan has violated that promise, and I don't believe he has any intention of respecting it at any time in the future.
Now, Jonathan, the general leading the coup d'etat is saying that he did what he did in order to avoid a civil war. Is he in the right?
He is partly right, yes, because when the civilian population started, you know, their demonstrations earlier, middle of this month, you know, up to last week or whatever. Yes, if those demonstrations had gone ahead, yes, chances were, you know, it could have escalated into some sort of a military confrontation. So in a way, he's right. But then, I believe the demonstrations by the civilian population leading up to last week also played into his hands. It was like, in my language, I can't go to Ghana. It's like, you know, when the mosquito wants to, you know, to enter your bedroom, you know, it's for, and the wind blows, it gives you the chance to enter your bedroom and bite you. So this is something that, you know, has happened in Sudan. The demonstrations actually played into General Benham's hands to say this coup d'etat on the pretext of avoiding a possible civil war.
Now, Robert, military leaders are saying that an election will be held in July 2023 in which power will be transferred to a civilian government. You know, multiple coup d'etats have been staged in Sudan in the past 3 decades, so it makes me wonder if a peaceful transition in Sudan would ever be feasible.
It's challenging, certainly. The issues that face the Sudanese people are many and complex. This is, as you mentioned, the fourth such a coup that the Sudanese nation has experienced in a relatively short amount of time. The elections could be held and could be reasonable, could be valid and democratic, if the governing leaders choose to allow them to be such. General Al-Burhan does not seem to be someone who would encourage that, based on the fact that he has taken this move today, or in the last couple of days. He was scheduled to transition, the country was scheduled to transition to a civilian government next month, is something that he has now prevented, and he has pushed it off for 2 more years. There were, as your other commentator mentioned, problems in the nation, as there will continue to be. However, growth is not always smooth and simple, and the Sudanese people needed to get through these difficult times to begin their civilian government in November. This has now been defeated. Whether or not civilian government will come to power following elections in July of 2023 remains to be seen, but none of the evidence that has been demonstrated so far, that has been presented so far, supports the idea that that will actually happen.
Okay, now let me ask Jonathan this. Jonathan, you know that the agreement between civilian and military leaders signed in 2019 was meant to push Sudan toward democracy, but it faced a number of coup attempts. So what's responsible for all of this, and is democracy possible in Sudan?
I believe democracy is possible in Sudan because the Sudanese people appear to be very politically aware. We shouldn't forget that. Before I go, we shouldn't forget that it was the people, actually, the demonstrations, the protests, or the sustained protests, demonstrations of the people that precipitated the downfall of al-Bashir. Okay, mm-hmm. So I believe the people of Sudan, the Sudanese people, want and demand democracy. So that sheer force of their will make sure that, aided by Western influences. Already the U.S. has suspended about $700 million of aid, okay? And if Sudan's allies in the Middle East, Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, also, put some pressure on this junta, I believe they'll follow the timetable and usher in, a democratic dispensation. I believe there's a light at the end of the tunnel where democracy is concerned. At least, because of the sheer will of the Sudanese people, democracy will be attained in the long run.
Robert, do you see eye to eye with Jonathan? And how can we be rest assured that the military will not repeat the same scenario it did just today in 2023 when the transition is going to take place?
Be sure that won't happen. In fact, I'm very pessimistic about the possibility of the transition to democracy in 2023 under the current military regime that has just taken over. The idea of the fact that the United States has withheld $700 million in aid, other countries may do the same, is going to make things difficult for the people of Sudan, but not necessarily for the government of Sudan. It depends on how repressive the military government chooses to be. We've seen the United States in the past cease foreign aid, issue sanctions, and so on. This has never brought about the desired result of a regime change. The United States always winds up going in militarily to overthrow governments. So I don't see that the U.S.'s withholding of foreign aid will have a significant impact on the government. It will certainly on the people, but how the government reacts to it remains to be seen. Sudan has other powerful allies that have not expressed a great amount of disapproval of this coup. I'm talking about Russia and China. They're both looking at it and cautiously, and the Russian spokesman have said that the inefficiency of the pending or the coalition government that had been in effect for a while is what caused this coup. I don't think that's the case, but I don't see Sudan's other powerful allies withdrawing from it at this time.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jonathan, speaking of the U.S., you know that the country removed Sudan from state sponsor of terror lists last year, and in June, it also paid a $50 billion debt relief package to Sudan. Now, some believe that this is aimed at kind of encouraging Sudan to sign the so-called normalization deal with the Tel Aviv regime. Your take on that?
Yes, I mean, it was a sweetener. Already, General Benham, when Netanyahu was prime minister, had a trilateral talks with Netanyahu and Donald Trump. Okay, mm-hmm. And again, Pompeo, the then U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, also called Benham to congratulate him, on trying to normalize relations with Israel. Yes, I believe this normalization will happen. Already, that everything has been set in motion. So I believe even it hasn't happened already, it will happen eventually. So, and to go back to the other guy in Canada, look, what I said was that the sheer force of the will of the Sudanese people will make sure, because the only resistance that the military will show will be to kill, you know, the civilians, to kill the protesters. And the more they do that, the more isolated they will be, right? And the more, you know, even their allies might turn against them. So they'll need to, the people demonstrating, asking for a return to civilian rule, will put much pressure, internal pressure, and also bring in external pressure for the military regime to make way for a democratic disposition in the long run. Maybe not in the medium term, but hopefully in the long term, in the long run, the democratic disposition will be allowed to take place.
Okay. Now, Robert, what do you think? Will Sudan be signing normalization deal with the Tel Aviv regime, and how will the people react?
Well, I think, as your other commentator said, that Sudan will sign the normalization. As with other countries, Arab countries that signed such normalization, of course, Sudan is an African country, but with a large Muslim population. But as other countries did, the people protested. It was not what the people in the countries wanted, but it was done for political expediency, often at the behest of the United States. Sudan will do for the same reasons, despite what the people of Sudan want. The United States will continue to fund the Sudanese government as long as it does the U.S.'s bidding. And one of the very important things to the United States is for Israel to not be marginalized in the world community, as it is increasingly due to its genocidal practices against the Palestinians, its constant violations of international law, and its crimes against humanity. The United States is willing to overlook those and will bribe other countries to overlook them too, and will probably be successful with Sudan, regardless of who is running the country.
Right. Now, one final question for both of you. Jonathan, who would benefit from a Sudan that's in disarray and chaos?
Nobody benefits, you know. The Sudanese people will lose, and I don't see anybody benefited. I mean, it will be losses all around.
Mm-hmm. And Robert?
I agree with that. The Sudanese people will suffer from this chaos. They will be unable to get foreign aid. As we've mentioned before, many countries will probably stop foreign aid because of this coup, at least for a time. And those people will suffer. The United States may decide to go in militarily under what it will say are humanitarian causes, which is what the United States does at different times and just makes things much worse than they ever were. But in order to get any oil or to prevent exports to Russia and China, the United States may do that. So this is a lose-lose situation for everybody.
Okay, Jonathan, would you foresee a U.S. intervention in Sudan?
I don't see U.S. Intervening militarily, but maybe diplomatically to try to exert some diplomatic pressure on the military. Yeah.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had publisher of the Africa Briefing, Jonathan Ofeansa from London, and also author and journalist Robert Fantina in Kitchener, Ontario. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The U.S.-led coalition, despite the staggering $2 trillion investment in the most advanced weaponry and intelligence, failed to eliminate terrorist groups like Daesh in Afghanistan, which lends credence to the theory that the group essentially serves America's objectives in the volatile region. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor, and blogger with over 10 years of experience, who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran for leading publications. The piece is titled, U.S. Has a New Proxy in Afghanistan, Daesh. The last U.S. occupation forces beating a hasty and humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, the war has entered a new phase where Americans and Daesh terrorists find themselves on the same side. The resurgence of Daesh terrorist group on the back of the U.S. exit has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban-ruled country in a way that works perfectly to the advantage of the Americans. The country, lying at the crossroads of South and Central Asia, has been rocked by a series of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, from Nangarhar in the east to Kunduz in the north, Kandahar in the south, and the capital Kabul. The ghastly bombings were claimed by Daesh terrorists in its new, more dangerous incarnation. It can be argued the aim is to undermine the newly established rule of its arch-enemy Taliban, and to stir sectarian tensions and civil war in a country with deep ethnic and religious fault lines. That's precisely what the Western powers, who spent years in the futile military adventure in Afghanistan, have been looking for. The move to freeze $10 billion of Afghan assets has to be seen in the same context, which is primarily designed to bring poor and war-weary Afghans to their knees. The disastrous end of the U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan 2 months ago also saw the resurgence of a terrorist group that has long shared love-hate relationship with the West. Amid the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces, Daesh terrorists and Daesh suicide bombers detonated their explosives outside Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport on 26th of August, killing over 170 Afghans, many of them making a desperate attempt to flee the country. 13 American troops were killed as well in the attack, which prompted the U.S. to launch a drone strike on 29th of August. That drone strike, ostensibly aimed at a Daesh hideout, mowed down 10 more poor Afghan civilians. It was America's parting gift to the people of Afghanistan, a people they held hostage for 20 years. And weeks after the final withdrawal, Daesh terrorists carried out several low-intensity attacks in their stronghold of Nangarhar in eastern Afghanistan, mainly targeting overground Taliban fighters. It was a continuation of a long-running turf war between the two groups with competing interests. In early October, the group went back to its favorite mode of urban warfare, suicide bombings. The sprawling Eidgah Mosque in Kabul was targeted on 3rd of October, killing 7 civilians. The attack took place during the funeral ceremony of Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid's mother. The worst was yet to come. While targeting Taliban convoys and funerals serves the purpose of undermining the newly established interim government, the other and more important purpose is served by attacks on minority groups. In both cases, Daesh terrorists has made common cause with Americans. On 8th of October, a deadly bombing ripped through a mosque in northern Kunduz province during Friday prayers, leaving over 150 people martyred, all members of the ethnic Hazara Shia community. A week later, another mosque was bombed in southern Kandahar province, which claimed over 60 lives. Both attacks, with the same set of victims and perpetrators, bore striking resemblance to each other. The modus operandi was the same, and the objective was the same. Victims in both incidents were buried in mass graves and, like always, reduced to cold statistics in the Western media. Daesh, which first made inroads into the Hindu Kush country in late 2014, has fought pitched battles with the Taliban in eastern Afghanistan all these years. At the same time, it has played the sectarian card by targeting the Hazara Shia community, as was clearly evident in recent weeks. Ironically, what Daesh terrorists are doing is no different from what the successive US-backed regimes in Kabul have done for a long time. Except that the latter didn't claim responsibility for any act of terror. They paved the way for it and refused to take any measures to put a stop to it. I suppose that is more reprehensible. The narrative that the US military-industrial complex has contributed to the growth of terrorism perpetuated by Daesh in Afghanistan has been gaining ground for quite some time now. The US-led coalition, despite the staggering $2 trillion investment and the most advanced weaponry and intelligence, failed to eliminate terrorist groups like Daesh in Afghanistan, which lends credence to the theory that the terrorist group essentially serves the objectives of the United States of America in the volatile region. Taliban officials have unequivocally blamed the United States for Daesh terrorist group's resurgence in Afghanistan. Ahmad Yasser, an official at Taliban's political bureau in Doha, Qatar, was recently quoted as saying that there is evidence to suggest that recent attacks on Shia mosques in Afghanistan had malicious foreign hand behind them. Qari Sayyid Khosti, who handles social media for Taliban, also held Americans responsible for the recent Daesh bombings. He refused groups' cooperation with the United States in fighting Daesh, saying the Takfiri terrorist group had made comeback with the help of the Americans and its Western allies. The leader of the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, in a speech recently, also stressed that the United States must take responsibility for Daesh presence in Afghanistan, accusing Americans of shipping Daesh terrorists from Syria into Iraq and Afghanistan. This claim, dismissed as a conspiracy theory by Western pundits, has been often repeated by credible military sources. There are also reports that the Taliban's interim government has been unable to locate the previous government's security files, which include critical information on Daesh terrorists. The files were discarded by the U.S. occupying forces before they fled the country. According to a United Nations report released in June, interestingly, in the months before the U.S.-led coalition forces left the country, some 8,000 to 10,000 terrorists made their way to Afghanistan from Central Asia, from North Caucasus, Pakistan, and Syria. Most of them were recruited by Daesh terrorists, which was evident from the Kunduz mosque bombing that was carried out by a Takfiri terrorist group. What is most remarkable is that these foreign terrorists slipped into Afghanistan under the very nose of US and NATO forces. Americans had the intelligence, but the political will was missing. Top US military commander Mark Milley went on record recently as saying that there is possibility of a broader civil war, reconstitution of Al-Qaeda, and the growth of Daesh terrorists. But no action has been taken, because Americans now see Daesh as a potential proxy to continue their botched mission in the war-ravaged country.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.